Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, Computers and You. This is a topic we take up once a month on the third Thursday of the month. Peter Kimball is our guest this afternoon. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I welcome your questions, your phone calls, your comments, your concerns. For Peter Kimball, you can join us with a telephone call this afternoon. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Peter, good afternoon. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, let's talk about security once again. What's the latest on viruses, worms, that kind of thing?
Well, there's a never-ending string of these things, and when you ask what's the latest today, then you're going to have to answer a whole different question in the next day or two. The biggest thing of these days is the social engineering kinds of viruses. These are the messages you get from Aunt Sally, or you get from your employer, or you get from anyone else. At least that's who it looks like it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to infect your machine unless you inadvertently or avertly click on one of the attachments. And so it's kind of surprising that people are still doing that, but when you have hundreds of thousands of machines that get infected in the course of just 24 hours, which happened with the most recent so-called Sasser worm, a lot of people are doing that. And so the underlying advice is just never click on any attachment, no matter who it seems to come to, and come from, because the email address of the person from whom it was sent, you can't even assume that the person who sent it to you has their machine infected, because a lot of these viruses and worms will now simply look at the mailboxes and the addresses from somebody whose machine was infected, and if John and Jane both happen to have their addresses there, then this mail is going to look like it's being sent from John to Jane or vice versa, and neither John nor Jane never heard anything about it.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of that kind of mail lately here on campus, and it's coming from presumably, or what it says is it's coming from a friend of mine in you know, and it's like, no, it looks suspicious, but they're getting to the point now where they look less suspicious.
They are getting better. Occasionally you can still tell by gross misspellings and just poor grammar that, you know, it was somebody who wasn't paying much attention, perhaps a kid or something who was using one of these little engines to create it. But the other thing to be aware of is that they are getting more sophisticated. They're even including relevant bits of information in the message, so that there was a spate of messages going around the U of I a month or so ago that said the welcome, this is a message from administrators of uillinois.edu, and
right,
we have a problem and we need you to click on this attachment
right,
to make sure that...
And here's the code.
And here's the code. Yeah. And so they try to make it seem legitimate, except that... in the case of the U of Illinois, everybody knew that that wasn't the way things were done.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener who's ready to talk with us this afternoon on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go ahead.
Calling about viruses and how they pertain to Macs and how the Macs on campus don't seem to be getting any viruses, since I'm take my answer off the air.
Okay. The there are a couple of things to be aware of with the Macs. First of all, most of the virus attacks have been for Windows, and I think the quote that's often attributed to Willie Sutton, "Why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is." Why are a lot of these viruses written to attack the Windows platform? Because that's where most of the machines are. However, I know a couple of people here on campus who are convinced that one of the next big waves of viruses, maybe it'll be in a month, maybe it'll be in a year, will actually target both Linux and the Macintosh, since the Macintosh is now based on a Unix or a Linux kernel. And there are a number of reports in some of the computer emergency response team sites and such about known exploits and known vulnerabilities. And the Mac is certainly not immune. No software system that has millions of lines of code, including the Mac OS and Windows certainly, is ever going to be able to be 100% error-free and exploit-free. So the major emphasis is being given to the Windows machines because that's where most of the activity is, but you really can't let up the guard on the Mac as well. And so Macintosh, Apple frequently releases, not as frequently as Windows, but still releases updates to the software. It's important to put those in. It's important to keep the virus protection up to date on the Macintosh as well, even though most of the viruses, again, as the caller has noted, are so far targeted towards Windows machines or to non-Macintosh Unix machines.
Okay. The utilities, the utility programs for viruses, are there separate utility programs for Macs and Linux?
The program has to be a separate program because what runs on a Windows machine, a software that runs on the Windows machine, it may be from the same company. So Symantec may make a version for Windows and for the Macintosh, but you can't take the one that you're running on Windows and just install it on the Macintosh or vice versa. And it's also very critical, and there's a couple of other kind of ominous things going on. It's very important to keep those virus definitions updated. When you buy a virus program from any of the major companies, you generally get a year of updates, and most of those virus protection programs now install so that they will check automatically. And that means that if you install your program, it will go out and phone home essentially and say, oh, there's a new set of virus definitions. However, the time between a spread of a virus, now that a lot of these email viruses are being so effective, and the time that the major vendors release a virus patch for it, and this doesn't matter whether it's Norton or Symantec or McAfee or any of those, may be 12, 15, 24 hours. And in that time, if this virus is making the rounds, somebody could still be infected. So that's why it's important to never click on anything you're not expecting as an attachment. Keep your operating system updated with the latest patches and all the rest.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling. I was looking to buy a laptop soon and looking at the Intel Centrino chipset and wondering, because it appears to be set up to be most integrated with 802.11b wireless, and I was wondering if they were making any plans to move that up to the faster G standard or if that was just going to be kind of a B-based thing.
I believe, although I'd have to look into it in more detail, for a lot of the listeners, the 802.11b and G refer to the speed of a wireless connection. One is nominally about five times faster than the other. But I believe that the Centrino, it's kind of like a Pentium chip that's designed to go into laptop and portable devices. It uses less power and is more effective. And I believe that that will be able to handle any of the 802.11 protocols. What is going to make the difference is, have they installed a wireless card or have they installed the wireless communication for the more pervasive but slower 802.11b, the kind of thing you'll usually find in all the various hotspots and hotels and coffee shops and such. But if you have the ability, depending on that laptop, to upgrade that to the 802.11, you know, the faster standard, then the same Centrino chip will be able to handle that. It's just that what is the kind of wireless networking functionality that they've built into that laptop, which is independent of the Centrino chip. The Centrino chip will work well with either one of them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Okay. Right. Next, we talk with a listener on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi. I wanted to go back with that earlier issue about viruses and getting return mail. And, you know, if you have your Symantec updated, which I do, I guess what I get these emails, which I find a little bit, you know, disturbing, because I don't want to have a virus or give anyone else one. And my friend, who's more computer savvy than I, says, oh, well, don't worry about it. You've got your Symantec updated. And, you know, this is just something weird. You know, you didn't send that email out to anyone, but now it's come back to you as undeliverable. But don't worry about it. So how do you know that you don't have a virus, or do you just have faith that your Symantec is working?
Well, partly you have faith. If you have been keeping your, excuse me, if you've been keeping your virus protection updated with,
yes,
with the subscription, and you have not been clicking on any attachments that come unless you
are
expecting
them. Well, you have to be careful about that, right?
Yes, because it's quite possible that
no,
the attachment that you've got is one that the next version of the virus update will handle, but the current one won't. There's oftentimes a day or two lag in between there.
Right.
And your friend is correct. There's not much you can do about it. The reason you're getting this mail bounced back to you, mm-hmm, is, let's take the example of Jane and John.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of them have a machine that's infected, but some third person does have a machine that's infected.
Mm-hmm.
It sends out mail that purports to be from Jane to John. John's mail service rejects it,
mm-hmm,
because it recognizes the virus, and it bounces it back to whom it appears that mail came from, Jane, even
right,
though Jane
like,
had never sent
on?
It. So you are an innocent bystander, except that there is some other machine out there that has your name on it and the name of the person to whom that mail was sent. And when it bounced back to you because the recipient's email server had no clue where to send it other than back to you, even though it was never coming from your machine in the first place.
Right. So I understand that how that works, but what if something else were going on? I wouldn't know that. I just assume that this is what is happening and it's not a danger to me or anyone else.
I think that's pretty much all you can do, because this is such a pervasive technique,
right,
to spoof the return addresses that you're, mm-hmm, going to get those. Now, a lot of mail servers these days, there's so much traffic that they just don't even bother to try to send back saying, oh, by the way, you sent mail that has a problem. That used to be useful in the old days before.
Right,
the
by the way,
virus.
Yeah, right, you're infected. Go do
yes.
something about it, right?
Or by the way, we couldn't deliver your mail because of whatever reason. But
right, it didn't go through. So
that is now becoming less and less common, and those few servers that are still doing it, of course, it contributes to the overall traffic on the, mm-hmm, on the Internet, and there's not much you can do about it. Recognize that anything that says, I couldn't deliver this mail, unless it's mail you recognize you sent,
yeah,
then you simply don't worry about it.
Right.
There's no way that you will be infected by something that's sent back to you, as long right. as it doesn't have the attachment there and you click on it or something.
Okay. Right. So then I guess this issue has been talked about many times, and I'm not up on all these issues. But do you think we're getting to a point of just, you know, overload and clog of email? I mean, we're all still using it. And I guess we're getting a little bit savvy about just deleting certain things and getting our, you know, different kinds of protection up or, you know, to keep out unwanted mail. So I guess it's just we do the best we can.
Yes. There are a number of longer-term solutions in the works. All of the major providers and email service places, Microsoft, Yahoo, and all the rest are certainly working on this. But email is so pervasive and at such a fundamental level of the Internet that it's difficult to change the rules and get things like validation and such.
Right. It's a necessary evil.
It is, but it's going to get better, but it's going to be a long process, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. I think the last numbers that I've seen is something over half of all emails are, you know, virus-laden or fraudulent or spam or
unwanted.
Unwanted, certainly.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 4, the toll-free line.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've got an annoying problem, more than pervasive for everyone else. On my home computer, I'm using a Windows XP operating system, and I have a Sony digital camera. And for the longest time, I could just plug that camera in and turn it on, and the machine would recognize that I wanted to move photos from the memory stick onto my computer. Now, it's just stopped doing that. And it'll work fine if I go to my wife's section of the computer or my kids, but on mine it says, I don't recognize if there's any camera out there. I have a scanner on there as well. It knows the scanner is there, but it just can't find the camera. And I'm wondering if there's something in the Microsoft auto detection thing that I can go in and click somewhere and make it work again.
Yes, there is, and I'm not 100% sure I'm going to be able to guide you through this in precise detail, but I can give you the general outline. It sounds very much like under your account, your USB driver, presumably this is connecting via a USB or a universal serial bus cable that you plug your Sony camera. And in general, what should happen is when that's plugged in, the USB drivers and the little bits of software that are there send a signal to the operating system saying, hey, there's this device, I recognize what it is and such. If that's not happening now, you've said you've got a scanner as well. Do you happen to know whether that scanner is a USB scanner or is it a how does your scanner plug into the computer?
I don't think it's USB.
Okay. What you can do is, and let me just double check here to make sure that that's what we want to do. You can actually go into the properties of your computer system,
right.
And just choose hardware and choose device manager. You'll find the device manager there, and I can't do it on this machine because it just told me I don't have enough privileges to do so. And you will find in there someplace a universal serial bus controller, and you'll find a number of those. And what you can try doing is starting at the bottom of that list. Now, do this at a time when you're not in a real rush to do anything because this can cause, you know, some odd little things happening. What you can do is you can then right-click on those and delete those USB drivers starting at the bottom of the list and working your way up to the top, and then shut down the machine. When you start it up again, the system will recognize, oh, you've got this new hardware. It's a universal serial bus. Going to find this, or else if it doesn't do that automatically, you can always go back to the device manager and say that you want to scan for new devices. So that's generally the approach. However, if things don't go smoothly, you may find that you're not going to be able to easily use the camera even on your wife's side of things until you actually manage to get this issue resolved. But that's what has happened on a number of machines in the past. For some reason, the USB driver has gotten corrupted or some settings are wrong, and uninstalling and reinstalling has fixed it. I would have gone through that a little bit more with you, but I don't have the privileges on this particular machine.
No, I understand, I think, what you're talking about. And I have gone through the device manager and do the troubleshooting, and it says, oh, yeah, your camera's there. I don't know what's wrong with you. But it wouldn't fix it. But I'll try this thing about deleting those USB driver devices and then
again, coming,
turning it off and on and let it recognize them again.
Yes, and good luck.
Thanks.
Okay.
Next, we talk with a listener on line one. Hello.
Hi. I have installed a Norton antivirus program, and I probably have asked this before, but I lost the information. How would I get a hold of them to buy a year's worth of backup and of antivirus updates?
You should have, when you bring up the Norton utility in your menu, I presume you're running on a Windows machine.
Yes.
And when you bring up the program, you know, from the start menu, the list of programs, and you'll see a Symantec or a Norton entry there.
Okay.
And among those, presumably, if you installed this fairly recently, now I take it you installed this some time ago, and so your subscription.
I think 2 years ago.
Okay, you should still have, quite possibly, if it's 2 years ago, there should be an option there for live update.
Mm.
This is one approach. If you go to live update, it will say, okay, connecting, oops, sorry, you are, you know, expired. But that will give you a link that you can, or a button actually in that window to click on, and that will take you to the Norton appropriate place on the Norton Symantec site where you can subscribe for another year of the update service. If that doesn't work, if you don't have a live update button, you can simply go to the Symantec site, www.symantec.com. You'll have to.
Could you repeat that, please?
Yes, www.symantec, S-Y-M-A-N-T-E-C.
.com. Okay.
And once you're there, that's a huge site for all of Symantec products. But you could choose the products and services, make your way over to Norton Antivirus. You simply have to navigate the web a little bit and find the appropriate location. Or you can do a search, and you will find the ability, the option to. In fact, there's even a link there to purchase, which I suspect will be to purchase an update.
Do you know what the price is per year?
It's someplace in the vicinity of $20, I believe.
$20. Okay.
I will point out that sometimes it depends upon the pricing and what kind of sales are going on. But the last couple of years, when it's come time for me to do that, I've gone to a site like Amazon, looked at the price for a brand new version of Symantec, especially what's called the professional version, which gives you a license to install it on two machines. Mm. And with the sale price and the rebates, it's actually cost me $10 or $15 total, which is less than the subscription price. So I've gone that route.
You think it's better to go that way to get a brand new program because of the...
No, because it doesn't really matter. The only reason that you would want to go that way would be if you wanted to get the dual license or if you found it to be cheaper, because part of the live update process will update the basic program, not only when you subscribe to one of these annual renewal, and this is true for Symantec and Norton, other companies mm-hmm. as well. Not only do you get the most recent virus definitions, but you'll also get updates to the core software itself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. Questions about computers. That's what we're talking about this afternoon. Our guest is Peter Kimball. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. It's Computers in You Day here today on the Afternoon Magazine. This is a topic we take up once a month on the third Thursday of the month. No one's waiting at the moment. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. We have a couple of listeners getting lined up now this afternoon, Peter. As we get them ready to talk with us, tell us briefly, what is the FAST 3 Consortium?
It was established at the university a number of years ago by several different units that were all teaching workshops on various kinds of software, using the web, using Office applications, Photoshop, that kind of thing. And it was determined that we could be more efficient if we coordinated our efforts, and so the FAST 3 was the Faculty and Staff Technology Training Team, I believe, is what they ended up calling it. I had nothing to do with that acronym. So the... net result is, for the last 7.5 years, we've been doing this wide range of mm-hmm. training programs, and it's expanded out beyond the university. It's still primarily for university faculty and staff, but every workshop has two or three people from public schools or just the public in general.
Okay, let's talk with some listeners now. First, we go to a caller on line one. Hi.
Hi. I've got a question about passwords for getting into Outlook Express and stuff like that.
Yes.
It always pops up, and you know, you have to put in your password, and it says, would you like me to remember this password? And you click yes, and it lets you in. And next time, it asks you for the password again, and again, and again, every time. It won't remember the password. Is there a way to get around that? Is there something screwed up that I can go in and fix?
Now, this is only in Outlook that we're talking about?
No. It's in Outlook Express, and it also happens in when I'm surfing the web. I don't remember if I use Internet Explorer or Netscape, but any place I need to enter a password, it always offers to remember it for me next time, and it never does.
Well, one possibility that comes to mind, and I don't use Outlook Express directly, but I suspect that as a Microsoft product, it's going to be very similar to Internet Explorer. And there is a setting in, let's see, if you go into the tools in Internet Explorer, and then you'll choose Internet Options. Okay. And one of the options that we have, and I'm just looking for it now, will be you can tell Internet Explorer directly, never remember passwords.
Okay.
And so if that's what's set, then that could be what is clearing them out, even though you tell the program, yes, I'd like to keep it. And I believe it will be under the Content tab.
Okay.
And let's see, there's autocomplete. And so there is a, yes, so I've found where this is located. So for tools... in Internet Explorer, and it's probably going to be something similar in Outlook. Internet Options, there's a whole bunch of tabs at the top. You click on the Content tab, and then down near the bottom it says Personal Information, and it says Autocomplete will store previous entries and suggest matches for you, and you click on that, and then you've got a choice that says use Autocomplete for names, for passwords, for this, for that, the other. And that's one possibility. There's another possibility. It depends upon This would not be usual, but I've seen it occasionally. It's possible to download a little bit of additional security or set the overall Windows security so that passwords are always wiped out when you leave the machine. This is typically done, for example, at public machines and libraries and such.
Okay, great.
So there is a setting someplace that is telling it, get rid of this.
Right. Okay. I will go in and look for that.
Okay.
Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line two. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have a problem recently. I sent an email to an individual in Southern California. I use att.net, and it came back not deliverable, will not accept att.net. Now, is that unusual?
So your service provider or the person that you're getting your internet service from is, or your return address is something at att.net?
Yes.
That is relatively unusual. The common cause for something like that is if a particular company or a particular internet service provider, let's say out in California, has...
Well, she's on AOL.
Okay. Well, AOL is... This is fairly peculiar. I would check and see. In general, what a company will do is if they are receiving a lot of spam or a lot of virus-laden email from a particular domain, so if, for example, some company in California was receiving a whole bunch of stuff from AT&T.net, which was virus-laden or spam mail, they could filter or block that. Usually a company of the size of AOL is not going to block all of the mail coming in from something like att.net because I would guess that that's a fairly substantial number of people who use that service.
I thought maybe she had a filter and thought I was a virus or something.
Well, it's possible. You'd have to be careful to see, but if you sent it to her at AOL.com, the message that would have come back probably would have been from AOL's mail servers. It's possible that she has set it's possible, and again, I don't know about the current version of AOL, but some mail providers and some systems are now set up with what is called a whitelist, where they have kind of overkill to my mind, but you essentially the only email you accept are those from those, or as email from those on a known list of good guys. And so if you're not on that list of good guys, then your mail is just rejected. Of course, that begs the question, how do you get on that list of good guys to start with? You call them up and say, put me on your list, I suppose.
I just took my email and pasted it on my works, and I mailed it to them. So.
Okay. So it could be, and you mailed it to the same address, and it was still through your AT&T.net provider?
I mailed it to the U.S. Postal Service.
Oh, okay.
Gave up trying to send it.
Well, what I would do is I would try sending just to make sure that there's nothing wrong at your end. You're able to send email elsewhere?
Oh, yeah.
To other addresses? Check and see, ask around, because probably somebody you know has an AOL account, and see if you can send email to them.
Okay. Now, what's the difference between worldnet.att and att.net?
They would be two different. They may be related to the same company, but they are going to be treated as two separate entities, and it could well be that one of them is being filtered and the other isn't.
I see.
And if one of them, the university has a few, it doesn't do it often because of freedom of access to information issues, but the university occasionally will block an address if it seems that the only thing that that domain is sending is spam mail. They will... announce we have blocked all email coming from such and such a range of addresses.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line three. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Got a couple of questions here. Bought a new computer this winter, and I'm just using the dial-up service. We're not real big computer users. But after checking around with the dealer taking the machine back a couple times, and then checking at home, apparently this modem built into my machine is more sensitive to static or interference or something on the telephone line.
That could well be.
And we get kicked off all the time. And I called a good old SBC one day, and the lady said, let me check your line. She called back. She said, yeah, there's a problem there. And so they sent a serviceman out, and he said, no, there's no problem. And I have gone so far as to take my machine to a neighbor's house and hook it up, and it works fine. And I've run a new dedicated line from my junction box outside to the computer at my house, and I still get the problem. So it's an outside problem.
Yes.
Is there anything you can do to the modem to make it less sensitive, or do I just need to keep bugging SBC?
You're going
to
need to keep bugging SBC. And I've had, we actually at my home a few years ago had the same sort of problem. The telling point is, and you can make this clear the next time you call them, is that when the dispatching operator checked your line, they found a lot of noise on it. Sometimes that noise, it could have been when the technician came out, things were better because it was drier. We had a problem that was much worse when it was wet.
Right.
And so just explain that to them, that they actually, there was a problem. Now, what you're likely to end up with, I don't know if your wire telephone lines come in above ground or underground.
I
would guess underground. And so when we did that, you know, for the next 2 months, we had this new telephone line laying across before they got around to getting out and trenching it in. But we had wonderful connections. But, yes, you're going to have to just deal with SBC on that.
One other quick question. We're normally using MSN or something here when I get on the Internet, and I discovered they were blocking a number of sites that I like to get to.
You probably have the ability, if you're using MSN, in the settings, and AOL does the same sort of thing as well. You can go in and just change the permissions. It's sort of like there are parental controls, in essence, that are in effect, that are blocking some sites that whatever list may mistakenly think that are inappropriate or have caused problems before. But that is almost certainly a function not of the Internet service provider, but of the way the browser is set up. And there will be somewhere in the MSN controls a way of saying, no, for this particular user, don't censor it at all. Let me go, you know, I can make my own decisions. You don't have to worry about me.
So that's something I would do within my own machine then.
That is correct. And within the MSN environment. I would suspect, for example, if you were to download an entirely separate, or maybe it's already on your machine, an entirely separate Internet Explorer, it's probably already there. You just start up in MSN, so now you're connected.
I've gone to, like, Google.
Right.
And not had that problem.
And so, yes, it's a setting inside your MSN browser. What you can do, what you can also try doing, is simply you start up in MSN, so you're all connected. And then just minimize your MSN window, pay no more attention to it, open up your standard regular Internet Explorer from the desktop, and that should not have any of the filtering going on.
Okay. I don't know how they get there. There's only two users, and you know, my wife claims she didn't do anything.
Well, it could be the default settings, you know, error on the side of being safe the way it was first installed.
Well, you know, it's a change, though. I was getting these sites.
Okay.
And I can't.
And there's another possibility, and the other possibility is that your browser has been somewhat hijacked. So I would download actually one or two products and then run them to check for any software that may be interfering with your ability to surf the web and to get to particular sites. One of them is called AdAware, AdAware. I just did this.
I think that may be on my machine.
If it is, then what you'll want to do is when you start it up, the first thing you'll want to do is go to there's an update option so you can get the most recent database, run the update, and then run AdAware, and it'll probably find a whole series of various programs that can be interfering with your surfing in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
There is another product that does much the same kind of thing, and they overlap to some extent, but not 100%, so I like to run them both periodically, and it's something called SpyBot, SpyBot. A Google search for SpyBot or a Google search for AdAware, if you don't have it, we'll find them.
Okay.
They're both
free. I think I've seen both of those.
Yes, they're both free for the download. They suggest if you like them and find them useful, you know, send them a contribution of,
right,
you know, $10 or something. But they don't expect that you're entitled to use it as often as you like, and just decide yourself when you would like to send them, if you would like to send them a little compensation for all their work. But
okay,
run both of those, and I suspect that if it's not a if it's not a parental control kind of setting, it's one of these other programs that's interfering, and either AdAware and or SpyBot should be able to find it and zap it for you.
Okay. Well, have fun there then.
Okay, good
Thank
luck.
You.
Next, we talk with a listener on the toll-free line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
This is an email question. I email my daughter in China, and she's on Hotmail. I have a local server, and intermittently the past whole month, sometimes the emails will go through, and more than often they'll come back. And I've talked to the server, at, saying, you know, that they don't recognize who it is. I've talked to the server, and he tried, and he thinks it's an intermittent problem with Hotmail. However, I have a friend in this town who uses the school email, and she gets through. So now where is the problem, do you think?
When the email doesn't get through, you get a message back saying this could not
be
delivered?
The whole email comes back, yes, saying that they tried to deliver 20 times and they didn't recognize the person.
Generally, yeah. That's the kind of message that you get if the email receiving machine, and if it's Hotmail, it's still probably a server that's someplace over...
Well, it's in China. It's okay, in Asia, and they're overloaded anyway.
And so that could well be that at the times you're trying to send it, even though it tries a number of times, it's failed. It doesn't sound like it's any problem at your end. The fact that it was able to run from your friend's account at school may simply be the time of day, or it may be just the luck of the draw. And the fact that it's intermittent, what you might try doing is sending the email at a different time of the day. Of course, you've got to figure out, what's the busy time over there, since they're about 12 or 15 hours different from us.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that, but I will try that.
I would try that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Okay, good luck. Let's talk with another listener. Line one, hi.
Yeah, using a Word document and then cutting and pasting from the web, what causes the computer to crash?
So you have something from the web and you're pasting it into a Word document.
Yeah, for example, what I do sometimes is that I'll go to Amazon.com and maybe I'm looking over some books and I like some of the, they'll give some information regarding, about books,
Sure.
The ratings and all that kind of stuff. And what I do is maybe do a series of them, or another thing I may do is maybe set up a whole list of books that I'd like to order, and then what I do is I also cut and paste the web address for it. But after I do it for a while or something or other, and then what I'll do, too, is go up and change the material. Usually it's HTML or something or other, and convert it back into, but maybe, I don't know what's causing it. After a certain amount of time, it ends up that it usually crashes on me. Not all the time, but from time to time.
You're using Windows?
I'm using Windows, right.
And you're pasting it into Word, and when it crashes, does it just crash Word? Does it...
Well, you'll actually tell me that something's going to happen, and if you don't hurry quickly, then it does crash. You know how that goes. if I don't, it will crash. When I call crash, that's when it freezes, right? Isn't that basically what it, when they crash?
Right, and can you, is it just Word that is unavailable then, or is the entire computer system locked up?
I do have something on the computer that will save some of the documents, but it doesn't save everything. If I happen to have something, quite a few things that are up, that it'll crash part of that too. I'll lose part of that.
Well, part of it could be occasionally, if you've got a lot of windows open and a lot of activities going on, depending on what the actual error message that you get, or the warning message, if it says it's, for example, running out of virtual memory, or it's running out of space, you need to deal with this somehow, then you may just be trying to push a little bit more onto your machine than is possible with the amount of memory that you've got, and a few fewer windows open at the same time, or somewhat fewer documents open at the same time.
Yeah, I've been thinking also, maybe it might be the format too, is that maybe it's picking up, in terms of when I'm bringing over the information, maybe it's picking up too much information.
Well, it could be, because when you copy a page with all sorts of information in it, there can be a lot of detail. One thing I might suggest, one quick way of getting that information saved permanently, without necessarily pasting it into Word, is from Internet Explorer itself. If you go up to the File menu and say you want to save that page, you can save that page onto your own machine into a folder wherever you decide, and then all you need to do is go back and at some later time, double-click on the file in that folder, and it'll open up a web browser, but it'll show you the page as you've saved it on your machine.
Okay.
Now, not all of the links may work appropriately, and some of the interactive parts may not work, but you'll at least have all of the information. But it sounds like you've got too many windows.
Yeah, I might be too. In fact, sometimes I've done it where I've just pasted a small amount each time, you know, a little bit about the book sections rather than picking up all the other material. And I think that usually probably works a little better. What about, can you get a virus from cutting and pasting from the Internet?
I suspect there might be some situations where you could, but it seems very unlikely. I don't think you really have to worry too much about it. The kinds of things that you're going to pick up when you cut and paste is essentially going to be images and text. Cutting and pasting generally doesn't pick up any underlying programs, and so you're probably relatively safe there. I don't think that's what's going on in your case.
Well, that's just curious because you were talking so much about viruses. Downloading and printing a page off the Internet, more than likely no problem with that either?
More than likely, at least for reputable websites. Some of the exploits that are used, and this would be mostly a problem if you had not kept your Windows system updated with the Windows patches, there are some illicit websites that you simply visit them, and if you haven't updated your Windows operating system with the latest security patches, you can get infected that way. But in general, if it's a legitimate, non-malicious website, as most of them are, commercial sites, you can certainly print them. Mm-hmm. You should not have any trouble.
And then one quick note, you talked about power lines. One time I was having trouble with my telephone, and it would just, and I didn't associate the dampness with it, but what happened is that I couldn't even use my phone. And then I'd go to a payphone call, and, you know, I'd still have some problems, and they checked it and all that kind of thing. And I actually did it again. They have, you know, a computer system. And actually the main power lines, not my line to the above ground lines, they spotted where actually, I guess a squirrel had bitten the line, so extra moisture got in.
Yeah, and a little moisture goes a long way, and we've had a moist spring, so.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Next, we talk with a listener on line two. Hi.
Hi. After listening to your program today, I think I have a virus.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and my computer is telling me that I have low virtual memory.
Which is quite possibly true.
Okay, and it's not letting me into some of the programs, or it might let me in for a little while and it will kick me off. But there's a program that I use every day to keep track of my spending, and that's Microsoft Money 2002.
Uh-huh.
When I wanted to save that to a disk, it told me I needed some outrageous number of disks. And I'm just wondering, I don't have a zip drive. Is there any way that I can compress it? I don't want to lose that information. I have a backup disk, so I could still have that program if I, you know, needed to restore. But I don't want to lose the information I've entered because it helps me keep track of tax information.
Sure. I don't know why your file would have gotten that large, but two suggestions. One is, if you are getting that virtual memory, one way of clearing everything out is to save whatever you have open and simply restart the computer.
Okay.
Which clears away any problems that you've got with the virtual memory. Make sure that you're updated with, you know, the most recent Windows version. Go to the Windows Update.
Update.
And that's if you're running Windows 98 or 2000 or XP or something of that sort, I presume.
XP.
Okay, then simply go to your Start menu and there's Windows Update. Make sure you're updated there. But you can also, that same window that tells you about virtual memory, I know it depends on which version you're running, but it may well give you the option of increasing the virtual memory.
Okay.
But you simply have had too many things open and closed, and it's running out of places to store some of the current status.
Oh.
So restarting the machine, and that shouldn't happen very often. It should only be after you've used it for a long time. And if you've left it on for days after days, then yes, every once in a while you simply want to restart.
That's it? Turn it off and turn it back on?
Well, yeah. I mean, don't just turn it off, but, you know, shut down, let it go through the restart process, and that should fix your virtual memory problem for at least quite a while.
Really?
Yeah. And the other thing would be, I'm not sure about the money 2002 or 2003 problem.
Uh-huh.
You may have a lot more information in there than you'd expected. If you have access to a CD burner, if your machine is recent enough to have that or you add one, that solves the problem because then you can just burn all of that information to a CD.
Really? Okay, I think I do have one.
then that'll be a separate, you simply put it on a folder and you simply drag that folder using your CD burning software and you've got yourself a nice permanent, semi-permanent record. CDs don't last forever, but they last a pretty long time.
Wow, okay. That's it. Thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. That's where we have to leave it. We're out of time. That went very quickly.
Yes, it did.
Lots of
does.
Callers this afternoon. Computers and You will take up the topic again next month on the third Thursday of June. This afternoon, Peter Kimball has been our guest. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade, a down day in the bean pit, down 38.5 cents in the nearby July contract. The Novembers were off 24. They dragged the rest of the grains down with them for the day as well. July futures in the wheat pit at 377, high, low at 365. Their settlement price for the day at 370.25 was down 6.75. September 383.5, the high, the low at 372.5. And a settlement at 377.5, down 6.5 cents. March contract in the wheat pit, 395, the high, the low at 389, settled 395, down 5.25. In the May futures, 391, the high, the low, and the settlement there, all at 391, down 4 cents for the day in the May wheat pit. July corn now, 297.25, the high, the low at 289, settled 292.25. They were down 6.25 on the day. September's were off 7.25 at 291.5 high, low at 283.5. That settlement price at 7.25 lower at 285.5 in the September corn contract. December futures 288.5, the high, the low at 279.5. The new crop settled at 282.5, down 7.25 in the December's. March futures 292.5 high, low at 284.5, settled 286.75, down 7.5. And the May futures 296, the high, the low at 289. That 7 cent trading range settled at 290.5, down 7.5 cents for the day. July futures in the corn pit, 295.75, the high, the low at 288. July 2005 corn contract settled 289.5, down 7.25, and the September 05 settled 278. They were 1.75 lower for the day, had a high of 279 and a low at 276.5. December 2005, now 2 years out, 269.5, the high, the low at 266. A settlement price there at 268. They were 1.5 lower for the December 2005 corn. July oats at 151.75 on the high, the low at 143.5. That nearby oat contract settling 5.75 cents lower at 144.25. And the September 157.5 on the high side, the low at 149.5. The trading range settled at 150, down 5.5 cents for the day. From the soy complex, this is where all the action really took place. There was some confirmation today that there is meal apparently being shipped in to the Gulf ports. And that could be the biggest reason the futures were turning sharply lower for the past few days. July beans, 898, the high, the low at 863, settled 869, down 38.5 cents. We know that meal was coming into the southeast and had confirmation actually on that yesterday, but there is word that that meal is possibly being shipped into the Gulf ports as well. 843, the high for the day in the August contract, low at 8.11, settled 8.16, down 33.5 cents. We'll talk all about that with Dan Zwicker this afternoon during the closing market report. September beans, 7.54, the high, the low at 7.31, settled 7.32.5. They were 26.5 lower. And the November contract, this year new crop, 7.04, the high, low at 6.80. Settled 683, they were down 24 cents on the day. January's 703, the high, the low at 685, settled 685.5, 21.5 lower. In the March, $7 even for the high, the low at 679, settled 683, down 22. May contract in the bean pit, 685, the high, the low at 676, settled on that low at 676 in the May 2005 beans, down 20 cents. July bean meal, 292, the high, the low at 280, settled 282.30, down 11.90. August bean meal, 277.50, the high, the low at 265.50, settled 265.80. They were down 13.40 on the day. July bean oil now, 29.60 for the high, the low at 28.50. A settlement price there, 28.65. They were down 110, and the August 28.95, the high, the low at 27.90, settled 27.99. August bean oil down 108 for the day. Now, with the Mercantile Exchange numbers, here's Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, Todd. Mostly higher day today for cattle, but lean hogs finished lower. May feeder cattle, 104 even, today's high price. The low, 103.25. The settlement, 103.90. That down 27.5. August, 104.35. The high, 102.05. The low, the settlement, 104.25. That up 132.5. September feeder cattle, 102.95. The high, $100.85. The low, the settlement, 102.87.5. That up 142.5. June live cattle, 83.30, the high, 82.15, the low, 82.97.5, the settlement, that up 12.5. July lean hogs, 87 even, the high, 84.50, the low, 86.75, the settlement, that up 25. August live cattle, 85.60, the high, the low, 84.35, the settlement, 85.12.5, that unchanged. June lean hogs, 74.90, the high, 74 even, the low, 74.15, the settlement, that down 90. July, 75.10, the high, 73.72.5, the low, 73.92.5, the settlement, that down 87.5. August lean hogs, 73.50, the high, 72.75, the low, 72.97.5, the settlement, that down 72.5. October lean hog, 61.95, the high, 61.25, the low, 61.82.5, the settlement, that up 2.5 cents. Pork bellies, today's high, 122.60, the low, 118, the settlement, 120.85, that up 182.5. The Dow is up 4 points at 99.42. The NASDAQ is off a fraction at 18.98. The S&P 500 is up 1 at 10.89.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Human Kinetics Publishers Incorporated, Champaign; Devro TPAC, Danville; and Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
J. Devin Patterson Willis from New Orleans, Louisiana writes, "Dear Dr. Science, can chlorine break up water molecules?"
Only if they had a rotten relationship to begin with. No outside party can break up a healthy marriage, but a couple on the verge of splitting up will always take a few hostages, just to make sliding out the side door a little easier. Quite reactive in their uncoupled state, chloride ions send out strong messages, broadcasting their availability and willingness to engage in chemical hanky-panky. They've been called the halogen homewreckers by those prone to the whimsical use of alliteration. Besides smelling bad, they have the ability to erase their responsibility in any situation by bleaching the evidence of their complicity. A return to traditional family values would eliminate chlorine from our drinking water completely.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science.